male, but fuck me? Taking all these factors into consideration, I wrote up a profile of the probable offender. I specifically rejected the idea that the vandals had been a group of adolescent males. The vandalism was too benign, too carefully done. All the clues pointed away from a group of males and toward a different possible perpetrator. The author of this damage and destruction, I said, was a lone white female, over 40 and less than 50 years of age, specifically someone who had no current familiarity with teenagers. She would be an extremely narcissistic woman and intimately involved with the items and the collectibles that were passed over in the vandalizing of the house. I postulated that she would be a woman who had difficulty with interpersonal relationships, someone who had been through several divorces during her lifetime. I theorized that she would be a close family member of the owner or renter, and that she had a vested interest in making the acts of violence selective, so that she would not wipe out items that she deemed to be irreplaceable. This woman, I guessed, had staged the vandalism to make it look like her conception of a typical act of male adolescence. Her attempts at reproducing youthful graffiti dated her and revealed her sex and age. No young male vandal would write, "Fuck me." This was a middle-aged and rather confused woman at work. She was probably not comfortable with the use of foul language, and the inscribed words reflected her notion of what she fantasized male hostility and antisocial behavior were all about. In contemporary terms, however, her choice of obscenities seemed childlike. If she had any children, I wrote, these would probably not include a teenager and not a boy. I thought it likely she was the mother of only one child, a daughter, and that the daughter did not currently reside with her. My reason for this, aside from her lack of familiarity with teenagers and male children in general, was the presence of the oil painting of the young girl in the home, and the fact that it was undamaged. Such an icon usually suggests an absent but favored relative. I thought that there had been a specific triggering event for this behavior on her part, that the perpetrator was probably responding to stressful events that had occurred days or at most weeks before the act of vandalism. There could have been, I said, a matter of money or of men, the loss of a job, or something that caused her immediate future to appear uncertain. Summing up, I said that the motivation for the vandalism was one or a combination of three factors. An angry woman committed the act of vandalism to retaliate against a family member. Looking for attention, this woman transformed her act into the sort of false allegation that we often see in trumped-up rape cases. The woman sought insurance money because she had undertaken improvements or renovations to the place and could no longer afford the renovations that she had ordered previously. I put these conclusions and the reasoning behind them down on paper for the West Coast psychologist and sent my findings to him. After he read my document, he called to tell me that the profile described almost perfectly the owner of the home, the woman who had reported the damages to the police and had made the claim for insurance money. White and in her 40s, she had broken up with her boyfriend, had money problems, had a daughter who lived with her former husband, and matched in many other details the personality I had postulated. The psychologist was rather amazed at my perspicacity. I wasn't. Compared to the profiles of unknown, vicious, antisocial criminals that I had struggled to compile and make accurate over the past 17 years in the FBI, this attempt at puzzle-solving was kid stuff.
9. To kill again? Police officer Kilburn McCoy looked like a cowboy, with Clint Eastwood-type good looks. And both he and his police officer wife Janet were attending a class I was teaching at an academy near Salem, Oregon, in 1980. At the end of the week, McCoy asked me to go down to his police station and look at the files on a murder committed in 1975 by a Vietnam veteran named Dwayne Samples, who was now in prison. McCoy thought Samples would be an excellent addition to the murderers we were interviewing for the Criminal Personality Research Project, because even though Samples was not a serial murderer, he had been convicted of killing just one person, he was articulate, a college graduate with a degree in psychology, and seem to have the sort of overwhelming violent fantasies characteristic of serial killers. Samples's crime had taken place during one terrible night in the small town of Silverton, Oregon, on December 9, 1975. Fran Steffens, her 18-month-old daughter, and her friend Diane Ross were in Fran's apartment, and a casual acquaintance, Duane Samples, came over for some beer, marijuana, and conversation. Samples was a counselor in a local drug clinic, a Vietnam vet in his early 30s who had knocked around quite a bit and had had fleeting relationships with several women in the area. He was interested in Fran, but his interest was not really reciprocated, though Fran did not send him away. As the evening wore on, the women became tired. Fran went to bed alongside her daughter, and Diane sat on the couch listening to Samples. He was boring her stiff with his stories of Vietnam, and she finally told him that she was tired and that he ought to leave. Samples left. Diane drifted off to sleep on the couch, then woke up to a strange, warm, sticky feeling, and discovered she had been cut severely, on the throat, across her body, under her breasts, and from the navel upward. 2 feet of her intestines were hanging out. It wasn't even the cuts that had awakened her. It was Fran's screams as she was being dragged into the bedroom by a knife-wielding Samples. Diane somehow held her arms around her torso and ran out the door. With 2 hands wrapping her gut, she couldn't hold up her pants, which had also been cut. She stepped out of them and stumbled down the block and into a neighbor's house through the kitchen and into the bedroom, where she told them, "I've been cut. Call a doctor. I'm dying." She worked hard at not giving in and falling asleep, thinking that she would die if she did. When the ambulance came, she heard someone say, "No need to hurry. She won't make it." However, they did hurry, and Diane Ross did make it. She remained alive and was able to tell the police that Duane Samples was killing Fran Steffens. The police rushed over to Fran's residence but found Fran already dead, cut in a similar manner to Diane, around the neck and on the torso. Blood and intestines spilled out over the bed she shared with her daughter, who managed to sleep through and escape Samples' slaughter. Blood was smeared on Fran's thighs, evidence of post-mortem attack on the body. There were also defensive wounds on the hands, showing that Fran had attempted to fight off her attacker. Samples was actually well known to the police in the area, principally through his counseling work, but also because he even played softball with some of the cops. An all-points bulletin alerted a pair of officers who drove to the apartment Samples shared with 2 other men in a nearby town. He wasn't there, but they found him shortly, and he surrendered peaceably. In his pocket, the police found a handwritten note to Fran dated Monday, December 8th, in which he asked her to show the letter to the police so that she could be exonerated from killing him. It said that he set forth to threaten Fran with her life unless she did as he instructed her. "Eviscerates and emasculates me." She was instructed either to do this or he would gut and mutilate her and her kid. The note went on to say that being killed by a beautiful woman was a lifelong fantasy come true, and that a part of him could hardly wait to see the blade cutting murderously into him. Samples claimed he had taken this note to Fran, who had refused to kill him, and this refusal had triggered his killing of her. It was a remarkable note, and we'll come back to it later in the case. Police and psychologists who interviewed Samples that night and in the following days said that he was oriented, knew who he was and where he was, knew right from wrong, and knew enough to ask for a lawyer. There seemed to be no evidence of psychosis as the basis for the crime. There was clear premeditation and thought involved in the crime. Samples had left the house, gone to his car, taken a fish filleting knife, and come back with the intent to kill both women. Diane even believed she had heard him coming down the block after her as she struggled to reach the neighbor's home. He was arraigned and charged with 1 count of murder and another of attempted murder. During the pretrial period, Samples and his attorney reviewed their options, and Samples weighed the issues very methodically, even putting them down in rows and columns on a piece of paper later obtained by the prosecution. His very deliberate actions in this regard show that his mind was working rationally at that time. Samples faced three choices. He could plead not guilty, stand trial, and risk having Diane Ross take the stand and testify to very damaging things about him. If he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, Diane could still be called to testify, and her story might outweigh his contention, supported by the note of Monday, December 8th, that he had not been in his right mind when he committed the murder. Samples and his attorney seriously considered the insanity defense for a time and unearthed his diary and other evidence of his long-standing preoccupation with disembowelment for use in such a defense. The Monday, December 8th note was also going to play a large role in that defense. It could be construed to show, more than premeditation, clear mental instability. In my view, the note was actually too well composed and thought out to reflect real instability. It was the creation of a semi-trained psychologist, working hard at creating an alibi. The third option, which Samples eventually embraced, was essentially a plea bargain. He pleaded guilty to murdering Fran in exchange for the charge of attempted murder of Diane Ross being dropped. This meant she would never be able to testify against him. In return, Samples received the maximum sentence available in the state of Oregon, 15 years to life. With good time and a little luck, he figured, he might be out of jail in 7 or 8 years. After Samples pleaded guilty, was sentenced, and began serving his time, the media lost interest in his case. Diane Ross recovered and moved to California, and Fran's daughter was raised by other members of her family. The prosecutor's office later admitted that because of the guilty plea, the prosecution had not looked extensively into Samples' background. Some evidence had been gathered, however. The note of December 8th referred to a lifelong fantasy of disembowelment by a beautiful naked woman, and this had indeed been a recurring theme in Samples' life for some time. At age 5, he slept in a bed between his mother and his pregnant aunt. The aunt had a hemorrhage and lost a lot of blood in the bed before miscarrying. The idea of spilling out internal organs seems to date back to this time. Later in childhood, he was stimulated by seeing an ant on his belly and felt that he wanted the ant to bore a hole through him. At the age of 13, playing Russian roulette, he accidentally shot himself in the abdomen. In a journal entry made after his experiences in Vietnam, he wrote that this was the fulfillment of a fantasy dating back to childhood, a gushing compulsion to feel steel in his guts. Initially, the fantasy had been of his own murder, committed by an Amazon woman spearing him during the sex act. Fran Steffens had been a relatively large and tall woman. He told a psychiatrist that his activities in his youth included, in the words of the psychiatrist's later report, pricking himself with pins or knives while enjoying these fantasies, which he found added to his erotic stimulation. Later, the fantasy included killing the woman. He had actually written out his intended M.O. in a threatening letter to a former lover well before the murder of Fran Steffens. This letter had many linguistic similarities to his December 8th note. It warned her that when she was in bed with a new partner, he would erupt from the bowels of darkness to open with a razor knife his taut throat. The letter goes on to explain in excruciating detail how Samples was going to disembowel both his former girlfriend and her new lover, sadistically torture them, and partake in their sexual act so that semen, blood, and other bodily fluids would all intermingle in orgasm and death. It would be the greatest sexual experience any of them had ever had, and it would be their last, himself included. After he had fatally wounded them, he also planned to turn the knife on his own gut so that they would be mutually dead together. From an initial look into Samples' background, a picture emerged of a smart man in the top 5% on the intelligence scales, a Stanford University scholarship student who had received his degree in psychology in 1964, then gone into the Army. He claimed to have served in Vietnam as a forward observer, calling in artillery strikes against Viet Cong positions. He came back to find life in America had drastically changed, enough so, he later said, to dash his idealism. After his Vietnam service in 1966 to 1967, he had become a drifter, with his own drug and alcohol problems. He was a bartender here, a social worker there, unemployed for a long stretch of time, moving from town to town, steadily north and west. He was evidently unable to hold a steady job until he translated his own problems into an ability to talk to people about these addictions and won a counseling position for college students and teenagers in the area near Salem. Friends and colleagues considered him a good counselor, and he had many allies in the social work community. In light of his background, many people would have concluded that the murder samples committed was an isolated, bizarre event, perhaps induced by drugs, an aberration. Most people who knew him casually, however, saw only the surface and had no access to his depths or insight into understanding the complexities of his character. On another visit to Oregon, during which I was also going to interview several other murderers in the state's prison system, I decided to try to see samples. He came readily to the interview, a balding, thin man nearing 40, with wire-rimmed glasses and an intelligent gaze, a thoughtful and soft-spoken man. He worked in the psychology section of the prison as a clerk and was a willing worker, participating in such experimental programs as biofeedback to teach inmates how to deal with aggressive feelings. I made my pitch and asked him for an interview that would help fill out the 57-page questionnaire that we were then using as the basis for our statistical analysis of the lives of murderers. He said no. Samples explained that he did not see himself as being the same sort of person as the serial killers and mass murderers whom I had been interviewing, and therefore did not want to be included in the program. He did talk to me unofficially for about an hour, during which he said that he was studying as well as working in the psychological section of the prison and planned, after he was paroled, to get his Ph.D. in psychology. He wondered whether, having completed his doctorate, he could get a job with the FBI's Behavioral Sciences Unit. Incredulous, I told him that the FBI would probably not agree to hire anyone with a prison record. I felt that in talking to me at all, Samples was merely stroking his own ego and fighting boredom. Since he hadn't agreed to participate in the interview program, there was no pledge of confidentiality given. I took no notes and did not run a tape recorder. I thought that was the finale of my involvement with Samples. From the pictures of the crime scene and other materials I'd seen, the experts I'd talked to, and my brief brush with Samples, it was clear to me that he was a classic sadistic sexual psychopath. He had refused to consider himself as such or to be lumped into a category with the others, but he displayed all the signs of such killers, from the quiet demeanor to the long history of fantasy that drove the murder he committed. In our terms, it was a mixed case, which showed dynamics of both the organized and disorganized killer. The crime scene was disorganized because of the gross disembowelment, the mutilation of the body, the blood smearing, and the lack of sexual assault. Samples had been organized in his planning of the murder, however. With a calculating mind, he had gone back to the car to get the filleting knife, and then had tried to kill both women. After the murder, he had the presence of mind to remove his jacket and clean up the crime scene. At the time of the murder, he was a person locked into a sexual fantasy involving violent behavior. Through the presence of drugs and alcohol, he was in the mood to realize his fantasy and had the opportunity, because both women were vulnerable. I thought it even more likely that Samples had written the Monday, December 8th note after, not before, the murder, in an attempt to provide himself with ammunition for a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. It was the act of a man who thought ahead, possibly not at the moment of his destructive act, but certainly in the hours after it, when the realization hit him that Diane had gotten away and that she would certainly be able to identify him. The next I heard about Duane's samples in early 1981 was that Governor Vic Attia of Oregon had commuted his sentence and that he was expected to be released shortly from the Oregon prison system. Samples had actually begun the application for commutation in 1979, and I had been unaware of that at the time I tried to interview him. His concealment in this matter had also caused turmoil in the Marion County District Attorney's Office. When the request for commutation was first made, there had been some notification to then-District Attorney Gary Gortmaker, who had not responded, that first request had been turned down by the governor, but a second request had been made and granted. In the interim, Chris Van Dyke, son of actor Dick Van Dyke, had taken over as Marion County District Attorney, and he and his assistant, Sarah McMillan, had gotten into the act. McCoy had given them my name as a person who could possibly help reverse the commutation. Local Silverton authorities had been alarmed when the commutation had gone through, and they had made their strong protest known to the county attorney's office. Van Dyke had become outraged that the governor would have made such a commutation without allowing the prosecutor's office an occasion to present a recommendation against Samples' release. McMillan wanted to know whether I could come out and testify with the prosecution against letting Samples out of prison. I agreed that he should not be released and told her that I might be able to testify, but that a request for me to do so would have to go through proper channels. Had Samples previously agreed to take part in the Criminal Personality Research Project, I would have disqualified myself, but since he hadn't, I was available if the Bureau chose to allow me to go. Shortly, Chris Van Dyke sent a letter of request to Director Webster, and eventually an arrangement was made that would permit me to travel to Oregon to testify. Samples had asked for a commutation based on two factors: his own rehabilitation and the notion that he had been mentally ill at the time of his crime, but that psychiatry only just recently had begun to understand and recognize the disease he had had in 1975, so a proper defense had not been available to him at that time. As for his rehabilitation, many people who spoke with him concluded that he had put his crime behind him and had been a model prisoner. He displayed all the correct behavior of a properly rehabilitated man. He wept when discussing the murder, said that it was a terrible thing, and argued that he could now control his aggression and would never commit such an act again. In the United States, Samples' defenders argued, we do not judge people before crimes are committed. Therefore, Samples should not be prejudged as to any future crimes, and he should be given a chance to redeem his life. Samples' rehabilitation claims were of the usual sort. What was unusual was his innovative assertion that the murder of Franz Steffens had been a direct result of his suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and that therefore he had not been responsible for that murder. This particular mental disorder had not been recognized by psychiatry in 1975, when the second edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders had been the standard reference, and so hadn't then been available for his defense. Part of what Samples said was true. All he could have found in the 1975 edition was something called transient situational disturbance, sometimes observed in veterans, a disturbance that had to do with sleeplessness, inability to hold a job, irritability, and sexual problems as a result of stress from a variety of sources, one of which was the stress associated with being in combat. In 1980, the third edition, known as DSM-3, had been published, and in it, transient situational disturbance had been upgraded from a rainstorm to a typhoon. That is, there were a few paragraphs about PTSD. Most of the description made reference to stress that was other than war-related. Nonetheless, the definition was there. This was the straw at which Samples grasped. His experiences in Vietnam, Samples claimed, had left him shattered, and after years of torment had tragically surfaced in his murder of Franz Steffens. With counseling in prison,
Samples now felt he had conquered this disorder that had once pushed him to snuff out a life. He hadn't been responsible for the murder in 1975, he contended, because of his PTSD. But now he had triumphed over the post-traumatic stress and, moreover, he was rehabilitated, and so should be set free. Two psychologists supported Samples's claim. One was in private practice and was receiving Veterans Administration funds to see Samples in prison on a regular basis. The second was an academic who had extensively studied veteran suffering from what was just becoming recognized as post-Vietnam stress syndrome. Lawyers who spend their time working for business corporations know enough to stay out of a complex criminal case, though they have a degree that says they are capable of handling one. Frankly, I thought these mental health professionals in the Samples case were similarly out of their depth. For example, the vast majority of the cases of PTSD that dealt with post-Vietnam stress had to do with veterans who couldn't hold a job, had sexual problems in their marriages, couldn't sleep at night, and had other similar complaints. To my knowledge, there were no other cases at that time in which PTSD was extended beyond these rather ordinary complaints to cover the disemboweling of two women. I did not doubt that Samples might well be suffering from some sort of stress as a result of his having been in combat in Vietnam, but the fantasies that had directed him to kill one woman and nearly kill the second had begun well before his Vietnam experiences, and were the controlling aspect of his motivation to murder. PTSD aftershocks usually occur within weeks or months after a precipitating traumatic event. Samples' murders had been committed 10 years after he returned from Vietnam. High in the pantheon of Samples' arguments for commutation was his contention that while in Vietnam, he had watched two fellow officers die rather horribly of disemboweling wounds. Samples even remembered their names, Hugh Hanna and Randy Ingram. Their deaths had scarred him mentally, he said. According to the academician's report, Samples watched Ingram, a close friend, literally being shredded by a Claymore landmine. He recalled placing the bleeding parts of his body into a basket for medevac, and seeing the blood run out of the basket as it was lifted up into the helicopter. Samples also avowed that he was a war hero, decorated for bravery in Vietnam, but that in his dreams he now saw his medals as being the color of dried blood. While in prison, Samples had married a woman who worked for a prominent advertising and public relations firm that was well connected in political circles in Oregon, and she had helped push for commutation. I thought it a bit out of character for Governor Attia to have turned down the request the first time, but to have agreed the second time to commute the sentence. Attia was a former businessman and state legislator known to be very much on the side of law enforcement, and publicly so. An antique gun collector, Attia would later pose for an advertisement for the National Rifle Association, which included a statement that said in part, "As a governor, I'm concerned with crime protection and Oregon's penal system. And like other NRA members, I want guns to be used safely and legally. We believe strict punishment is the best solution to crime with a gun." In his several years as governor, 100 commutation requests had crossed his desk. He denied all but 4, and the other 3 were virtually without controversy. One of these, for example, was of a wife who had killed the husband who had abused her for a decade. Well, perhaps the governor had been given bad advice about Samples, or had decided that releasing Samples would be a gesture of goodwill toward the community of Vietnam veterans, who had not been well treated by the public at the time of their return from the service, but who were being hailed in retrospect as heroes by incoming President Ronald Reagan. I had some time before I was expected to go to Oregon, and in the interim I did some digging. As a reserve officer in the Army's CID, as well as being an FBI agent, I not only had access to Army records, but also the experience to know how to evaluate those records. I asked the Army to check and see whether officers by the name of Hanna and Ingram had been killed in 1966 or 1967, and obtained a copy of Samples' discharge form, a DD-214. Everyone who is discharged from the services gets a copy of their own 214, and it shows their service record, including all medals and citations. Samples' 214 showed no medals for bravery. Another document in those records were special orders addressed to Hanna that covered many topics, among them ones that mentioned Samples' name and, in another paragraph, also mentioned a Randy Ingram. The Army further informed me that while men with the names of Hanna and Ingram had been wounded in that time period, neither had died, nor were there dead officers with names that were somewhat similar but spelled differently. Interestingly, the two mental health professionals who were willing to testify on Samples' behalf appear not to have researched his claims about his war service to the point where they could have better determined whether or not the patient was telling the truth. I thought it likely, though, that Samples had requested and received his Army documents. He conducted an extensive correspondence from prison, for instance, managing to win a monthly disability check based on his stressful experiences in Vietnam. That was why the VA sent a private practice psychologist to see him on a regular basis. To obtain that stipend, he would have had to cite his records. Samples was quite concerned with records and documentation. John Cochran, a forensic psychologist who worked regularly in the Oregon prison system, believed that Samples, as a clerk in the prison's psychological section, had altered and retyped his own prison records so that they would show he had been rehabilitated. This allegation of tampering with the records was never proved, however, as some of the records disappeared entirely. Cochran was used to working with inmates and thought Samples was a classic sexual sadist. Cochran repeatedly told the authorities and the press that such a condition was not really curable. In other words, that despite the outward signs, Samples was not rehabilitated because he could not be. There was reason to believe, Cochran said, that if Samples was released, he would kill again. He recommended against the commutation, but his expertise was disregarded. When it came time for me to go to Oregon to see the governor, my wife was in the hospital after a serious automobile accident. Though she was injured, she still urged me to fly out and fulfill my obligation. The controversy over Duane Samples had already reached the press in a big way. The commutation battle had also become a political one, with the Oregon legislature beginning consideration of bills that would undercut the governor's power to issue such commutations. Statements in the pages of the Oregon newspapers and on television news programs articulated the arguments of both sides. One side said that Samples had been rehabilitated, and that if our society believed at all in the rehabilitation of prisoners and in the possibility that mental disease can be treated and reversed, Samples should be given his chance at a new life outside prison walls. Many psychologists and psychiatrists, though not those who worked regularly in prisons, held this view, as did Vietnam vets and their political supporters and many liberals. It was an attractive view to hold, one that saw human beings as capable of change and growth, one that believed in the ability of psychiatry to treat mental disease, and in an optimistic prognosis for a man who seemed to have been rehabilitated. The other side contended that Samples was a sexual sadist whose outbursts had been constrained only because he had been behind bars, that there was a distinct chance that, if released, he would repeat the murderous behavior that had already landed him in prison, and that, therefore, he should not be released. It was, in a sense, a pessimistic view, one implying that psychiatry can understand mental disease, but that some conditions are beyond treatment, and that had reference to the fact that many, many inmates in prisons are recidivists who repeat their crimes after their release and have to be caught and incarcerated again. To my mind, both arguments were a little windy. I prefer to reason from facts, and the facts I had found all indicated that samples fit the pattern I had already observed in so many cases of serial murder, in which a man whose violent fantasies had been developing since childhood eventually realized those fantasies and murdered someone. Samples' own writings, his drifting, drugs, and bad relationships with women in the years prior to the murder, the details of the murder itself, and his lying about his military record and the source of his problems, all were indications of recognizably psychopathic behavior. The Oregon prison system already held several men who had similarly fit the pattern and committed multiple homicide, including Jerome Brudos and Richard Lawrence Marquette. Both had been prematurely released from confinement by the state after a history of bizarre fantasies and violent acts in their younger years, only to kill when allowed to return to free society. In nearby California, Ed Kemper had killed many more people after his own premature release from an institution where he had been placed for having murdered his grandparents when he was a teenager. None of their murderous fantasies had subsided, even after incarceration. They were stable while in custody, but that was not an indication that they would be capable of living on the outside without again resorting to murder. Near the end of June 1981, and the night before we were to see the governor, the prosecution's team sat down together. In addition to Van Dyke, McMillan, and myself, there was Dr. John Cochran of the Forensic Psychology Service of the Oregon State Hospital, Stephen H. Jensen, Unit Director of the Correctional Treatment Program at the hospital, and Dr. Peter DeCourcy, a Portland psychologist who had evaluated samples in 1975 just after the murder. We discussed what we would do the next morning, and in the course of it, I suggested to Van Dyke that, since Samples was basing his commutation on post-Vietnam stress syndrome, that his claims could be verified or refuted through examination of his military records. Van Dyke had had these in his hands, but hadn't looked at such things as the DD-214, which showed no awards for valor in combat and certainly no Bronze Star. Nor had the prosecutors thought to ask the Army, as I had, whether Hugh Hanna or Randy Ingram had really been killed in combat. Sarah McMillan asked me if I could find out whether Randy Ingram was alive, and I said she ought to do it officially, but said I'd make a try as well when I returned to Quantico. Next morning we went to the State Capitol building to make our presentation. I was up first, and I found Governor Attia visibly nervous. He asked me whether I was from the local FBI office, and when I said I had come from Quantico, he wanted to know what this issue had to do with the FBI since it was not a federal case. I explained that I was an expert on violent criminal behavior and had come at the request of the Marion County authorities, a request that had gone through proper channels at the FBI. We had expected this sort of challenge. I had even discussed it with the legal counsel people at Quantico and at FBI headquarters before traveling to Oregon. We had all agreed that it would be wrong for me to comment specifically on samples, and so I confined my remarks to Attia and his aides, to six similar cases that I knew very well, including those of Brudos, Marquette, and Kemper. I hit hard on such matters as Brudos and Marquette, stressing that these men had been prematurely released from prison after early murders, and that because of their lifelong violent fantasies that they could not control, they had killed again shortly after release. My presentation was scheduled for 20 minutes. After the first 10, Attia left the room and did not return. We were told he had an important matter to address. I got the distinct impression that the governor had realized the information and advice he had previously received was insufficient for him to have agreed to the commutation. He seemed to prefer to be seen as somewhat distanced from this matter, not personally involved, that it was really a matter to be dealt with by his aides. Those aides listened politely but appeared to make no notes as I continued my presentation. Then the mental health specialists made theirs, which described Duane Samples specifically as a danger to society
and a man who would most likely remain so in the future. I flew back home believing the controversy was now behind me. We had given the governor the information he had previously not had, and now the matter was in his hands. But the shouting wouldn't stop. Before Governor Attia even rendered his decision, Marquette filed an appeal for commutation similar to that of Sample's. Marquette's was summarily turned down. Attia's decision on Sample's was eagerly awaited, but was not forthcoming. In the next month or so, under the prodding of Sarah McMillan, I managed to locate Randy Ingram, who was an insurance salesman in Illinois. He had been an enlisted man, not an officer in Vietnam, and had been wounded, but he said he didn't remember Sample's, though he had been with Sample's artillery unit. I conveyed this information to McMillan, who publicized it widely. Then Sample's struck back. The man who had died, he said, was named Ingraham, not Ingram, as he had previously insisted. The Army confirmed that a man with that name had died in Vietnam during 1966 or 1967, but had had nothing to do with Sample's unit. Sample's other blow was to insist publicly that the prosecution team's presentation was faulty, since it spoke of a sexual crime and, he said, there had been no sexual attack during the murder. How could there be a sex crime without sexual contact, he argued. As the listener knows from the earlier cases and examples in this book, the lack of penetration of the victim's body is characteristic of certain types of disorganized murderers who are nonetheless fulfilling sexual fantasies in their killings. But this explanation requires a lengthy narrative to be effective, and in the arena of the public mind is not able to overwhelm the sort of phrase that Sample's used, the sort that fits neatly into a television soundbite. The controversy interested the CBS program 60 Minutes, which did an investigative segment that was fairly shallow. Post-Vietnam stress syndrome was an idea whose time had come, and Duane Sample's was an articulate man. Together, those elements proved irresistible to the news program. CBS presented a sympathetic view of Sample's plight. By this time, Sample's knew all the right things to say and what to display in his behavior. How could such a polite, contrite man be disbelieved? The United States was putting the Vietnam War behind it, and we had to be understanding about its last victims, our soldiers who had fought and come home to disdain. CBS seemed to feel that the clinching argument in the case was that the attempt to impugn Sample's by reference to Randy Ingram's non-death had failed. Those attempts were still not complete, however. While in Europe on an army assignment, I managed to locate Hugh Bud Hanna. He had become a major, assigned to SHAPE headquarters in Belgium, and I talked with him there. He remembered Sample's vividly, because Sample's was supposed to have been his replacement in that forward observer position, and there had been a problem with Sample's. The Stanford graduate had been counseling enlisted men against the war and was considered less than stable. Rather than send Sample's into combat right away, the brass had decided to return Hanna to that post and see whether Sample's straightened out. While in that forward post, Hanna was shot, hit in the mouth, tongue, and palate. When it came time for him possibly to testify against Sample's for his anti-war activities, Hanna could hardly speak, and the issue was mooted. I conveyed what I knew about Hanna's physical health and other comments to Van Dyke's office, which passed them on to the governor's aides. The summer wore on, and the governor still wasn't making public his decision. Then Sample's former commanding officer got into the act. Toward the end of August 1981, Colonel Courtney Prisk told reporter Bob Smith that he had known Sample's in Vietnam, as well as any commanding officer knows a lieutenant in his unit, probably better because we talked often. In Smith's article, printed in the Silverton Appeal Tribune, Prisk went on to say, "Duane showed concern for the enlightenment of the times. He was a guy I thought needed frequent counseling to keep his spirits up. He was strange, not peculiar, but strange. He was disturbed by things that did not disturb others. Prisk pointed out the fact that Ingram and Hannah were alive, not dead, and recounted that there had been one casualty in his unit from a Claymore mine, but it had been 300 yards from samples, and he doubted that Duane had even seen the event, though it had been talked about in the unit. Prisk summed it up for the reporter. "I believe Samples has taken two or three things he saw or heard about and fabricated them into something. Duane Samples was a good soldier and did a good job in Vietnam. There's no question about that. That's why that whole stress thing is just so much bull." Maybe it was the commanding officer's statement that finally swayed Attia or his aides. Maybe it was the convincing presentation that I and the other members of the district attorney's team had made, or maybe it was the public outcry that expressed itself in pressure from the state legislature in the form of pending legislation to limit the commutation powers, and in alarm from many ordinary citizens expressed in the letters to the editor columns of the newspapers. But in late 1981, Attia reversed his commutation decision. Samples would serve out the remainder of his sentence until the parole board, if ever, saw fit to release him from prison. After the commutation decision, Samples came to believe that I was the culprit, the man who had unfairly confined him to jail, and he mounted a campaign against me that took several reams of paperwork and several years to resolve. The boogeyman could not be someone like John Cochran, who had known him well, or any of the other mental health professionals who had treated him and who had been in the forefront of recommending that he be kept in prison for a good long time. No, the culprit had to be the hired mudslinger from Washington, the man who had wanted to interview him officially, but whom Samples had turned down. Samples enlisted state legislators and even a United States senator in the process, writing letters to ask them to prod the bureaucracy for an investigation of my role in the whole affair. I had slandered him in front of the governor, Samples alleged. I had no business saying anything about his crimes or those of serial murderers. I wasn't a Ph.D. in criminal psychology and, therefore, was not academically certified enough to know anything about anything. As is usual when the bureaucracy is prodded, an investigation is undertaken, and everyone has to spend a lot of time and paper answering the inquiry. That's what happened as a result of Duane Samples' typing away in prison and trying to get me. Fortunately, both Van Dyke and I had proceeded precisely by the book and had a lengthy paper trail to cite and to show to anyone who was interested. Eventually, I had to give a sworn deposition to the FBI's Office of Professional Responsibility. Their decision that I had done nothing wrong ended the official inquiry into the matter. Duane Samples was released from prison in 1991. I certainly hope that he has been truly rehabilitated and will not repeat the sort of crime for which he had previously been convicted. Only his continued proper behavior will demonstrate that, of course. 10. Tightening the net. Back in the 1950s, a serial rapist and killer was slashing his way through the Los Angeles area, but only one investigator suspected that several seemingly unconnected murders of young women were attributable to that lone killer. The search for that killer led, a quarter century later, to the formation of governmental structures for tightening the net around all future serial criminals. Harvey Murray Glattman was a killer ahead of his time. In the 1950s, he put advertisements in newspapers that promised women auditions for modeling jobs. His ads said that professional models were not wanted, but that good pay could be obtained by young women with no experience in modeling. Women answered his ads, and when they did, he offered more money than they were making in their current jobs for a few hours of discreet posing. He'd convince them to go to a secluded apartment, then ask them to take off more and more clothing as he photographed them. Glattman understood that it was most likely the women had not told friends or relatives where they were going, in case they might disapprove. Therefore, the women who posed for him would not be missed for some time. Glattman seems to have told himself that, because these women were willing to take off their clothes in front of a stranger, they were inviting rape. And so he raped them. Then he killed them so they wouldn't talk about the rapes. It's a pattern that was later replicated by other killers, Jerome Brudos in Oregon, for instance. I say that Glattman was a man ahead of his time because the idea of putting personal ads in the newspapers was new in the 1950s. Today it's commonplace, with fringe newspapers and sometimes even mainstream magazines printing personal ads enabling two strangers to meet. You've seen or heard of such ads. Young bachelor, handsome, seeks woman interested in sharing experiences, skiing, dancing. Most of the ads are legitimate. A few disguise a rapist or killer looking for victims. In Glattman's case, the ads were a reflection of 15 years of fantasy development, during which he had steadily escalated from infantile sexual experimentation to making passes at girls, to minor sexual assault, and then to rape and murder. Los Angeles homicide detective Pierce Brooks was the man put in charge of the investigation of two seemingly unrelated murders of young women in the area. Brooks was already an unusual man, a naval officer and blimp pilot who had become a top investigator in Los Angeles. He was frustrated during his investigation because although he felt that one man might be responsible for both murders and possibly some others in the area, he had no systematic way of checking his hypothesis. So he personally combed the newspaper files in several counties surrounding his own and local police files to see whether other murders had been committed that matched the M.O. of the killer he believed he was chasing. To make a long story short, this spade work eventually led to the conviction of Glattman, who, when confronted with the evidence, confessed to the murders. Glattman's extensive confession, obtained by Brooks, is one of the earliest documents of a serial killer's mind that we have, and it reflects many of the factors that I have outlined in other chapters of this book. Among the most interesting aspects of the confession were Glattman's rationalizations and reports of his conversations with the women after they had been raped. As with many killers, Glattman became annoyed when a woman would try to control him, for instance, by saying that she would not tell her roommate about the rape if Glattman let her go, and that made him angry enough to kill her. Actually, the chances of his having let her get away after the rape were near zero, for he was in the clutches of a fantasy that had been forming in his mind for many years, a fantasy that included murder. Glattman was tried and convicted, and then executed in 1957. Brooks attended the execution. If any of this sounds familiar to you, that is because both the killer and the detective in the case have become the subjects of fictional treatments. In a seminar for mystery writers a few years ago, I presented the case of Glattman, and Mary Higgins Clark asked me for more details, which I furnished her. She used the Glattman story as the basis for her recent best-selling novel, Loves Music, Loves to Dance. Years earlier, the detective in Joseph Wambaugh's celebrated book, The Onion Field, was Pierce Brooks, though that book deals with a case other than the Glattman matter. Brooks's experiences in trying to pry information from other police jurisdictions in the vicinity of Los Angeles led him to propose a system for linking all the departments in California so that future criminals could be tracked and trapped more easily. He envisioned doing this by computer because teletypes, another option, were clumsy and not conducive to sharing information. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, computers were quite new, very large, and very expensive, and California said it couldn't afford to buy computers and use them for such police purposes. So Brooks put the idea on a back burner and went on with his career, becoming chief of homicide detectives in Los Angeles, and, later, chief of police in Springfield and Eugene, Oregon, and in Lakewood, Colorado. In the mid-1970s, when I first began seriously looking into the personal histories of serial killers, the Glattman case caught my attention, and I studied it from the public records. As the listener knows, I spent the late 1970s putting together the Criminal Personality Research Project, getting it approved by FBI headquarters, and obtaining a Justice Department grant to interview convicted murderers. In that project, and in the growth of the Behavioral Sciences Unit, we were beginning to institutionalize some of the personal initiatives that I had made. By this time, Teton and Mullaney had retired, and I was the FBI's senior criminologist and criminal profiler. From what had been almost an ad hoc handful of men looking into murders, rapes, and abductions, we had become a formal group of people who profiled cases for local police and were reaching out to do research in the prisons. In addition, and despite some foot-dragging inside the FBI, I had managed to start a program to train experienced field agents as profiling coordinators, bringing them to Quantico in 1979 for an intensive course in what was becoming a bit more of a science and accordingly less of an art, then sending them back to their field offices. There, 55 newly trained agents became the resident experts in profiling, aided in our research, and acted as coordinators when there was a case where our help was sought. They funneled information to us and took our analysis back to the local police departments. In 1981, Quantico director Jim McKenzie and I were sitting at a bar drinking beers after work, and I was waxing philosophic. We had already established the greatest training facility for law enforcement in the country, perhaps in the world, and our fingerprint files and our evidence analysis laboratory had long been considered the best available anywhere. I reminded Jim that the laws had recently changed and that the FBI had new latitude to work in the areas of violent crime that had heretofore been solely the province of local police departments. And I suggested that we now ought to develop at Quantico, with our growing resources in behavioral sciences and our field coordinators, a National Center for Violent Crime Analysis. Under that umbrella, I'd put the CPRP, special training for police interns, programs to take the results of the research projects and apply them to such areas as assisting police in making out behaviorally oriented search warrants and conducting interviews, and other aspects of our in-service training for local police and for our own agents. Deadpan, McKenzie said that it ought to be the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, and that by switching two words, the concept had become his idea. We both laughed, understanding the joke about the way in which bureaucracies worked and management superiors took credit for everything. McKenzie recognized that the National Center was my idea, and that it was a good one. In the years following, McKenzie fought hard to make the NCAVC a reality, and it certainly would not have become more than an idea without his tireless endeavors. Organizational change does not take place in the federal government without a well-placed and indefatigable champion of the cause. The NCAVC eventually absorbed all of the behavioral sciences programs at Quantico with which I had been associated. The listener will recall that Quantico began in 1972 as a training facility for in-service agents and visiting police, as well as for new agents. Much of that training of experienced personnel was later subsumed under the NCAVC. In addition, the umbrella idea incorporated a lot of research and information-gathering programs that had never been done at Quantico before I started going out on my own to interview convicted murderers in prisons. From the original Criminal Personality Research Project, for instance, similar projects were developed that looked more closely at child abuse, at arson, at rape, at the minds of assassins, at spies and counter-spies, and at other important subjects in criminal justice. The NCAVC became, in effect, the Behavioral Sciences Research and Training Arm at Quantico. The Behavioral Sciences Unit had enlarged its universe considerably. While we were looking into the possibility of establishing the NCAVC, I learned that a man named Pierce Brooks had obtained a small grant from the Justice Department
to study the feasibility of establishing a violent criminal apprehension program. After more than 20 years, he had revived his dream of the late 1950s and had done so in a day when working with computers had become much more acceptable and a lot less expensive. In the interim between the era when Harvey Glattman was an active killer and the early 1980s, there had been a large and significant change in the landscape of